Talk.
Lunch with Pippa Hudson
on Cape Talk.
Join the conversation.
Time for this week's book club, and I have to read a lot for this job in preparation for interviews all across the show, not only for book club. So I seldom have the luxury of reading a book and sitting and thinking about it and dwelling on it after I've put it aside. I'm usually reaching for the next one and moving on. But the book we are featuring today is one that made me sit and pause and think deeply. And I'm still thinking about it about a fortnight after I finished it. It is in my head and I don't think it's going anywhere for a very long time. It is a memoir called All the Young Men, and it is the story of how a young woman living in Little Rock, Arkansas in the mid-1980s found herself thrust into the heart of the rising AIDS pandemic. Ruth Coker Burks had no medical training. She had no personal connection to the local gay community. It was a matter of pure chance that she stumbled upon the fact that literally dozens of young men in her town were dying of this strange new illness, and many of them were dying alone, rejected by their families, shunned by their community, even by their own medical staff. And what follows is the story of how a young, divorced single mother risked her own social and financial security to help these young men when nobody else would do it. Now, Ruth told her story to writer Kevin Carr O'Leary, and they have produced this incredibly moving memoir called All the Young Men. Time differences to Arkansas meant we couldn't do the interview live, but I was very honored to be able to have some time with Ruth a little bit earlier this week, and we'd like to share that interview with you. Ruth, welcome to Cape Talk, and thank you so much for chatting to us today, as well as a big thank you for this incredibly powerful book. Your story begins in 1986 in a conservative Arkansas community where being gay wasn't just socially taboo, it was still prohibited in law. There was a massive amount of fear and stigma attached to AIDS, even within the medical profession itself. People didn't understand it, they didn't yet know what it was or how it was transmitted. And there you are, a young woman, divorced, single mother, in your 20s, mid-20s, visiting a friend in hospital when you suddenly find yourself brought face-to-face with the reality of HIV. Tell us briefly what happened that day.
Well, I had gone to the hospital to see my friend who had cancer surgery. It was her fifth reconstructive surgery, so we had been there for 5 years. And friends with the nurses, and we loved the nurses, and they loved us. You take cookies up there, and, you know, everybody eats out of the same bag. And one day they were drawing straws to see who would go in and check on this young man. And I just couldn't believe it. His food trays had started appearing outside his door. He had, like, you know, three or four, six maybe trays outside his door that no one would even go in and feed him anymore, take his food into him. And so they were drawing straws to see who would go in and check on him. And these were the nurses that we loved so much. And I could not believe what I was seeing and hearing. And so I snuck into his room.
What you found in there was a young man in the final hours of his life. Jimmy was his name, and he was crying out for his mother. And the first thing you did is what everybody, I think, would naturally want to do. Let me try and find your mother for you. And you phoned her and said, I'm here at the hospital, and your son is asking for you. Ruth, what did that mother say?
I don't have a son, and don't call me back. My son died years ago, and don't call me back. And hung up on me. And I thought, oh, no, you're not going to hang up on me. And I called her back, and I told her that if she hung up on me one more time, I would put her son's obituary in the hometown newspaper, and I would list his cause of death. I had her attention.
It didn't change her mind, though, Ruth. And there you sat faced with the reality that Jimmy was going to die on his own, which was something you couldn't make peace with. So you went and sat with that young man and held his hand in the final hours of his life. That was a moment which totally changed the trajectory of your life, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. He was, you know, I couldn't let him just be there alone with no one. And, you know, when I went back in and I didn't know what on earth I was going to tell him. And so when I went back in, he looked up at me and he said, oh, Mama, I knew you'd come. And what was I supposed to do? Leave him and, you know, say, no, I'm not your mother and she's not coming. No, I stayed with him for 13 hours while he took his last breath on this earth.
Ruth, the story of those hours moved me to tears reading this book, but it's only the beginning of your story, because from that moment, you were set on a path into a totally different future from the one you had had the day before you walked into that hospital. The first thing you faced was what to do after Jimmy was gone, and his family had rejected him. They didn't want to know anything about him. The hospital wanted him gone. They didn't want that young man's body sitting, taking up a room in the hospital, and it fell to you to bury his ashes in your own family cemetery. There is a peculiarity of your own family's history that leads to your having access to more cemetery space than most families would. I'll leave that for the readers to discover for themselves. But tell us what you did with Jimmy from there.
Well, I took him and I put him on my father's grave. I buried him there. I went and bought an urn for him at a pottery shop and got an urn that was damaged, and, you know, it didn't cost very much. And so I buried him on my father's grave.
Ruth, that was the start of your journey with all the young men, because it wasn't long before your phone was ringing and there was another hospital calling with another young Jimmy lying in a bed dying of AIDS with nobody to look after him. And they weren't phoning to say, please come and be compassionate, there's a young man alone. They were phoning to say, we want him out of our facility, please come and make this problem go away, weren't they?
That's it. That's it. I took him to the hospital one night, and they had a police car there. And they called the police because they said, we're not equipped to take an AIDS patient. And they were going to send him to jail instead of treat him. And I told them, I called the administrator at 2:00 in the morning, and I said, you know, I'm going to get you the very best publicity that you could never afford, because every satellite truck will be here from Little Rock at 5:00 in the morning, and I'll let you explain to them why you won't take an AIDS patient.
Did it work?
Absolutely it did. Absolutely.
I think it's worth pausing for a second just to reflect on the time in which this story began, the mid-1980s. Can you sketch for our listeners who might not know or remember or weren't alive then to know what the situation was, how society viewed HIV and AIDS, and for that matter, homosexual men?
Well, it started in the churches, and the churches said that it was God's punishment for you for being gay. And they didn't want to have anything to do with them. And, you know, it was punishable by up to a year in prison for men to have sex with another man. And that, you know, they were throwing people in jail left and right, which, you know, is ridiculous. But, you know, I'm not so sure that it wasn't more homophobia than it was fear of AIDS, because they didn't know enough of, there wasn't enough information out about AIDS for them to be able to make a judgment on it. I think it was just the fact that they were gay was enough.
Mm. And, of course, nowhere near any kind of meaningful treatment at this point. Still a lot of unknowns around how the disease was transmitted, who was at risk, etc.
Right.
You found yourself taking on the role not only of caregiver but of information gatherer, because one of the things you did for these young men was to help them physically, with finding housing for them, with applying for disability benefits, feeding those who needed feeding, getting access to treatment as treatment became available in the later time. But you also helped to help them mine through the red tape of managing the process of death. Ruth, talk to us a little bit about the resistance you encountered, because there were many funeral homes that simply refused to deal with these young men, weren't there?
Oh, there were. There were funeral homes, and there was a cemetery that wouldn't let me bury an AIDS patient, and he had his feet propped up on the desk, never stood up like a proper gentleman when I went in to, you know, make an inquiry, and he said, I don't want him buried in my cemetery. And these were cremated remains, He said, I don't want all those AIDS juices running down through the other graves.
Wow.
Now, you can't be any more ignorant than that. And, you know, the people were treated horribly. They were treated, people loved being so cruel to gay men. It was unbelievable.
Ruth, your intervention came at significant personal cost as well. And a lot of people would have walked away from this saying, this actually isn't my problem. Somebody else can handle this. But you refused to give up. You refused to give up despite the fact that this came with social stigma on you, with being rejected by members of your own church, people refusing to not just acknowledge the work you were doing, but just have nothing to do with you. And it also came at significant risk for your relationship with your young daughter, Alison. She was only four when you met that first young man, Jimmy. You were a single mom, a divorced single mom. Were you worried, Ruth, that your work with these young men might cost you your custody of your daughter?
Oh, of course I was. That was my main fear. There wasn't a judge around who would not have taken my daughter away from me. And for having her around gay men, number one, and then for having her around people dying of this horrible disease. And so I would take her out and we'd go and do something nice for, you know, an AIDS patient. I go, now, honey, you can't tell anybody where we've been or what we've done. So I thought, what am I doing teaching my daughter to lie about doing good deeds? Mm.
It came at social cost for her because word did get out. It became known what you were doing. And to a degree, Alison also paid a price in terms of ostracism at school, didn't she?
Oh, she did. She was only invited to one birthday party. And when we got there, it was at a McDonald's. And they said the party had been an hour ago. So they changed the time on her invitation.
And yet, reading about the woman she is today, the woman that she grew into, and the relationship she developed in the course of helping you with this work, I can't help but think that this was a massively, massively positive influence on Alison, what she learned about compassion and about humanity and the human connection she made, because she really developed very special bonds with some of these young men, didn't she?
Oh, she did. She loved them and they loved her. And I think she was an integral part in them living as long as they did. They had a family. They had people who cared about them and, you know, wanted them to live, told them that they were of great value to us and to other people. And my guys lived until the day they died. They lived, they squeezed every bit of life they had out.
In the epilogue of your book, Ruth, you write, it's been nearly 30 years and so much has changed and yet so little. Now, I felt the same way. Reading this book, part of me was horrified to think that it seems like just the other day that people thought like this, that minds were closed like this. And at the same time, there was a sense of relief at, look how far we've come since then. Of course, some things have come far. Our understanding of HIV has changed massively. Our ability to treat it has changed. But in many countries, the kind of laws you reference against homosexual behavior are still on the statute books. Being gay is still something that has to be hidden. HIV is still seen as something of a punishment for immoral lifestyles, as it would be called. So a lot hasn't changed. But what did you mean when you wrote that so much has changed and yet so little?
Well, I finished it during the years that President Trump was, president over here. And, you know, the trans community could no longer serve in our military. They had served bravely until, you know, he said they couldn't. I had friends who were literally marrying women that did not know they were gay because they were so afraid of being gay and being out in Trump's America. And, you know, we can't let this happen again. We've got to go back and start almost back at square one with education. That's the only thing that will handle AIDS, is just, you've got to get rid of the stigma. And because that's what's killing people as much as anything else in the developing world, And, you know, we also have to do more to help our fellow human beings and our fellow humans in the rest of the world. We've got to, it's been 40 years to, we've been waiting on a vaccine. 40 years. They came up with a COVID vaccine in a matter of months. So it's time that they cough up a vaccine for us now.
Mm-hmm. Ruth, I can't help but wonder, did any of those parents who rejected their children encounter you later in life? Did anybody change their mind, reach out to you to say, I recognize that what I did was wrong and that you were the person who was there for my child when I should have been? Did anybody reach out to say thank you?
No one. Not one of them. And, you know, at this point, the parents are probably all deceased now, but no one at all ever reached out for anything.
How do you think they would feel if they could read your book today, if they were still with us? Is part of your intention to make them reflect on their own behavior, to challenge the parts of your community that still feel this way?
Well, I didn't write it for the families that left their children because they don't matter to me. I wrote it for my guys so that their lives would be remembered, so I could say what really happened here.
That was the author Ruth Coker Burks talking to us about her book, All the Young Men. Cannot recommend it highly enough. It is an extraordinary read and an absolutely indomitable author, I think is the word you've got to use for Ruth. Written with Kevin Carr O'Leary. It is published by Orion and available in South Africa via Jonathan Ball Publishers. You'll find it in all the big stores at around about 355 Rand a copy. Interesting message in from somebody listening saying ignorance, denial, fear of social stigma. These have all been part of my partner's journey with a different condition for which there are no ARVs. But the lessons from your guest's experience are healing in themselves. Ruth really is a mentor. And thank you for that. And our best wishes to you and your partner. Again, the name of the book, All the Young Men, the author Ruth Coker Burks, written with Kevin Carr O'Leary.